Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This is a second interview with Wayne White. He's the author of Cold, Three Winters at the South Pole. I wanted to talk with him again because of some of the paranormal experiences we talked about, starting with a house that other people in the town he lives in consider to be haunted. Wayne, not so much. You have a house that has a reputation as being haunted, and maybe you don't feel that way, but other people might suggest that. Can you go into some of that, why it might be considered haunted?
Yeah, Wendy, first off, it's an honor being here on your show. And, you know, I own the old Baylor Norville house in Rockport, Texas. And I never really thought about that angle. Well, I kind of did. I'll talk about that later. I was coming home once in a taxi, and the guy pulls up in front of my house and says, "Oh, my God, you live there?" I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, why?" I said, "Why? You know, what do you mean?" And he said, "Well, it's haunted, right?" And I kind of laughed and said, "Well, I don't know, but things really get moving around midnight. You know, I wanted to keep it going, if that's what he thought." Yeah, because the home's built in 1868, and it's here in Rockport, Texas. It was then owned by some interesting people. It certainly doesn't have, you know, a grand lineage of owners, but one of the guys was a Confederate cavalry officer, for example. A person like that lived in a whole different world. So this old house, a couple of things. One, it's old. People have died in it. I know that. Not thank God, not in terrible circumstances, but naturally, that's something that I know has occurred.
Yeah, naturally, but sometimes that doesn't mean that they leave, because if they're happy, sometimes that's why they stay.
Yeah, and you know, listen, let me start with something that I think it's important people would understand where I come from in this. You know, I was looking at the word skeptic, and I would be one to say, well, I really don't, you know, really, you know, believe in some of these things. But then again, if I start going through my life and the things I've experienced, I really have to say, well, wait a minute, what are you saying there? And I was thinking when I was out walking today about the word skeptic, and I have kind of a problem with the word skeptic, because it sort of approaches looking at a problem like, show me it exists or I'm not going to believe it. I'm going to believe that it doesn't exist unless you prove it to me. And to me, that's almost a negative way of looking at something, versus you could also be an advocate where you want to see these things, want to see them so badly that maybe you do. But I look at things more in the neutral. I'm not skeptical. I want to have an open up a mind, a mind open enough to be able to, you know, see things. And I also realize that there are people that are maybe more perceptive to things like this than others. So here I am. I buy this old house. I've had it now about 24 years. And I know a little bit about the history. I know it's really old. And I do believe in energies and things, whether it's from an old structure that has had people live in it and die in it, or whether it's from some of the things that physical things like I brought from my collection around the world, some very interesting articles. So the first thing I did, I remember the first night I was in this house, and I was in bed, and I you know, I talked to the house, and I said, okay, if there's any spirits in here, listen, we're going to get along famously. Here's what I'd like to do, though. Please, I will take care of you. I will take care of this house. I will love you and do everything I can to protect you and keep this house well. But please, no apparitions in the middle of the night. Nothing 6 inches from my face that I wake up to. Please, nothing like that. And I've never had that. I get nothing but a good feeling in this old place.
Okay, so basically you kind of made peace with it when you moved in, just on the chance that there might be something more active.
Absolutely, and I do with the things I bring back that I brought back years ago from the jungle and other places around the world, some things that have some interesting energies. That's the first thing I do with it, is make peace. And you know, I don't know. And like you mentioned about the natural causes, yeah, that doesn't mean a spirit couldn't still be there. It's just that in these cases of great trauma, I just think that there could be a real negative aspect to that maybe, and that would be something that would be maybe a little bit different than a natural death. But I don't know. I'm certainly no expert on it.
Okay, so saying that, it hasn't really been a big presence for you, but have other people, when they visit or come to your house or house sit, have they had experiences?
Well, we had one experience once where my house had broken into. I was overseas, and I got home, and house hadn't been opened in months, and I was walking through the house, and I keep it really perfect and clean and all locked up at that time, so no one would have been in here for several months, and I walk into this old, my old green room that I'm in now, and one of these old rifles that I have is sitting on my leather chair. I didn't leave it there, and I thought, well, that's odd. But then again, once the doors are closed in this place and I'm gone, who knows what goes on in here? So I was fine with it, and I just placed the rifle back where it went. Went through the house. Nothing was really missing or moved around or anything like that. Then I found a little bit of some broken glass, a tiny little bit. And I saw, hey, a window had been broken. It was a little pane, and then from that, the window could be opened. But it was shut. So they just reached in or whatever. But I had a friend come over, and he's Chinese, and he's quite superstitious, and he was looking at it, and he said, Wayne, this has been broken from the inside out, so I don't know.
Okay, so that one's curious. It still remains unknown.
Yeah, that's unknown, so who knows? And, my wife has told me that people have said the same thing to her when she says, oh, you live in that place, and she'll just say, yes, we do, and everything's fine. But it's just amongst some of the older people here that know, they know it's the oldest house in town, and, it would have certain things. But I don't know of any real stories, although I do know a story about a fellow that died in the house, but it's actually a good story, and it was... We do have one guy that lived here. His name was Uncle Bill, and we've talked to his descendants about his time on Earth, and he was known as kind of a curmudgeon. He wasn't liked by a lot of people, but he had lived here for many years, and one day, there was two doors down, there was a death in the family. An old guy passed away, and they were related. Uncle Bill and this guy were cousins or something. They were related. So they had a wake in the other person's house for the dead fellow, which they did back then, a wake. And so Uncle Bill went to the wake, walked down the two houses, goes to the wake, leaves at some point, comes back in this old house, and at some point drops dead in the house, in this house. Well, someone found him shortly after, dead in the house. And the talk for years that Uncle Bill did that on purpose just to one-up the guy that was having the wake.
So, and that would do it, yeah, upstage.
Yep.
Okay, well, that's not spooky. That's not spooky.
No.
However,
no.
Given when we previously talked, and that was about your book, Cold, and the fact that you have done some traveling, and you were a Marine.
Yes.
You've also visited some places that some people would consider highly, highly haunted, and not necessarily the best place to go camping. So
definitely, yeah. I can talk a little bit about that. There's, I do believe in energies, and for some reason, I'm drawn to like battlefields and sites of great, great struggle. And so I've been to battlefields, particularly in remote areas around the world, and one that really kind of loomed large. And by saying doing this, I was never seeking any kind of paranormal experience. That just wasn't my thing. I'm more interested in the guys that fought there and the great, the great sacrifice those men made. And one of the places was many years ago. I was in South Africa, and I'd always been drawn to the Zulu War of 18. It was around 1870, 1879, right around there. And where the British went down, and they were going to conquer the Zulu king because he wouldn't fall in line with what they wanted. And so Lord Chelmsford, had a large contingent of British troops and some natives with them and some other folks that marched in the Natal province into Zululand. And they were going to, stop this insurrection amongst the Zulus. And the Zulus really weren't doing anything other than following their traditional ways. And I think that it was more of a land grab type thing. And the British knew they'd have to do something with this Zulu king and this kingdom in order to accomplish what they wanted. So they marched in there, and you read the guy's diaries, and they would basically say the only thing they were afraid of is that the Zulus would run and not fight because these Brits wanted to fight. Well, they got a fight, and they got it at two different places. One was the Sandawana, and the other was the Rorke's Drift. And I walked, in 1993, I walked from Peter Maritzburg to the battlefields at Rorke's Drift and Osendowana. It was about 120 miles. I wanted to walk it because I wanted the just the feel. That was the route they took in 1879, walking and then horse-drawn wagons and things like that. And I thought that that long walk would give me a better appreciation of when I got there, even though the seasons were different. They were in, you know, wet season. I was in a drought. Nonetheless, I got to see those same mountains that those troops would have seen and got to those same battlefields. So after that walk, which that alone was an interesting thing, just walking along and doing that, because the country was really coming unglued. It was right before the election in 93, and there were all kinds of problems. I get to Rorke's Drift, which is the site of one of the battlefields, and I get to make camp there. The local, the Lutheran church that kind of ran the battlefield let me make camp. Now, Rorke's Drift was a famous part of the battle where these Brits were very, very outnumbered. There's like 160 of them. And they, but they had enough time to get ready for a Zulu attack. And they've been set up all these boxes and things and made these perimeters and were able to get in this defensive position. And through just a valiant effort on both sides, the Zulus with a much larger force, there was thousands of Zulus and about 160 Brits. But because the Brits were in this defensive position and knew how to use their weapons and such, most of them survived that battle. And many Zulus, you know, bravely died trying to attack this mission station. Well, I spent the night there and inside the area where the Brits would have been, and I slept well. I'd been walking for days and I was tired, but I'll never forget actually feeling refreshed and feeling good sleeping inside that area where I was. So I go on, have a nice meal to play, you know, the next day, stay at this little place, and I head to Osendowana. Now, Osendowana was a whole different battlefield. It's at a mountain thing that looks kind of like the Sphinx in Egypt, the mountain there, and the British set their camp up in 1879 with about, it was around almost 1,500 men set up a camp. Now, these guys have artillery, they have rockets, they have modern Martini Henry rifles at the time, and they were attacked by a Zulu force of over 20,000 warriors, and they did fight. And they attacked that British camp in this bullhorn formation that they would use, encircled it, and killed every one of them, except there were a couple stragglers that were able to kind of ride away. But they killed every one of them. And, that was the greatest defeat that I think the British ever suffered. Absolutely annihilated there at the base of that Osendowana Mountain. I made camp there. I asked to make camp there, and the ranger that ran it said, you know, you couldn't do that. But he said, I had a letter written from the previous place I'd been to saying, this guy has walked over 100 miles. Can you please let him camp? And the guy that wrote the letter was a famous author who'd written on the Zulu War. The ranger said, you won't want to camp here. He said, two Dutch guys tried to do it, and they ran away in the middle of the night. They left their camp and ran down the hill and wouldn't go back. So, you know, knowing that, I said, oh, I don't care about that. I'll do it anyway. And I made my camp. Now, this is where things get interesting because I don't seek experiences. I wasn't looking for anything. I was tired from the walk. I knew the next day I'd be in a car heading to, you know, like a safari type place. And so the walk was over. I was feeling good. I brought this whiskey that I had in this container that I was going to have some of it. And I sprinkled some of it on the graves that were around there from these Brits, dead Brits. And then of course the Zulus died, many of them. And I thought it was going to be this great night up there and a feeling of, you know, hey, I walked this far and here I am with my mates here in the battlefield. And right away, it didn't feel like that at all. The sun started going down and the place got cold. I mean, it's Africa, but it felt cold, and I felt cold. And I just had this feeling of this just dreadful kind of feeling. It wasn't what I thought it'd be at all. And I got in my tent, and I remember laying in there, and a couple of things happened. One that was strange was my stomach started just roaring. I had, like, this gas just roaring. I'd never heard anything like that before. And I'm laying there. And what was interesting was the Zulus would ritually disembowel who they'd killed afterwards to release spirits. And I've got my stomach doing this strange roaring that I've never heard anything like that before from God knows what. And I know I'd eaten good food, so I didn't understand that. And then, Wendy, as I'm in this tent and I'm feeling cold, and it is kind of a dreadful feeling. The wind is kind of blowing, and I'm hearing what sounds like voices outside my tent. Just just like, and it was like these muted voices, like you'd do if you were walking a picket. You wouldn't be talking out loud. You'd be talking in kind of a muted voice. And I could hear this, and it's like, what is this? At some point, I got out of my tent, saw nothing. It was just cold and stars. Got back in the tent, was finally able to get some sleep. But I'll tell you what, I packed up quickly in the morning and got down that hill. It was quite an experience. And what I felt when it was all done was I certainly wasn't welcome, but I was tolerated. And that was good enough.
I was wondering if you were on the wrong side of the battle.
I was on the back side of the battle.
I was on the end. It's like they probably tolerated you. The story would be what the Dutch guys ran from, you know, what, because probably had that same inner, that stomach roiling that you described, and then thinking, this is enough, we're done, okay.
Yeah, they left their tent and everything, they ran down the hill, and I could sort of see why. I toughed it out, and I didn't ever feel in any kind of a danger, just a dread feeling, a kind of a depressed, dreadful feeling, and it was okay. There wasn't anything there running me out of a place. It was simply, okay, boy, this is it, buddy. You wanted to be here.
Yeah.
This is what it's like. And, well, I was honored to be able to do that.
That's okay. That's a different thing. There's a way when you're going with reverence, I think that energy you bring with you is what you said. You're trying to honor the both sides, you know, honor their sacrifice. And so that's a different kind of presence and presentation. I think the implication of the activity you felt with this isn't a celebration, okay? This is,
no,
you know,
not at all.
So I think that's what the message in that, and that's just my personal opinion, was saying that, you know, this is not a party. This is not, you know, the Dutch, they may have had a different kind of expectation, and you don't know if their welcome was a little more enthusiastically cruel than yours, you know?
Yeah. I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't, something like that. Because I go into any kind of story I have that's sort of like this with great reverence toward, you know, and then same within this house. You know, great reverence for anything that's been here before me and might still be around, and any, you know, and so in that particular situation, I knew what those men on both sides had gone through, and had great respect for both sides in that, you know, terrible disaster, which ended up being, you know, bad for everyone. But I went into it with that, not like it's party time at a Santa Juana.
You also collect artifacts, and you have an artifact room in your house, I think, which also is part of the reason that the broken glass was there and the shotgun was on the chair.
Yeah.
I picture Night at the Museum and with all of these kinds of things. Can you talk about some of the most unique elements?
It's interesting because it does look, you know, Night at the Museum would be good. And I've been in here late at night and always feel pretty good about it. But whenever I brought things back, and a collector, it's strange. Collectors can be odd. You know, you get into this passionate kind of desire to own and try to possess things. And my wife and I are totally different that way. She was a believer early on. She didn't understand the whole need to collect. And now I kind of get it. And now I've broken that where I don't need to own anything, because what I've learned is you don't really own anything anyway. Mm-hmm. You just have it in your possession. But having it in my possession isn't bad, because then I can pass it to other people that do, versus it sitting rotting somewhere. So there's a plus to it. Nonetheless, I would bring things back from different places I've been in the world, like, you know, Africa, New Guinea, the Amazon, and other places. And a few pieces here are maybe a little more going than others. And one, I've got a little coffin, a dayak from Borneo, that would hold human bones, and it did at one time, that sits up in a kind of a position of honor. I got it many years ago and in Borneo, and I didn't rob a grave to get it. It was in this incredible, I wouldn't call it an antique shop, because it was before the days of much commercialization, but someone who just kind of picked this type of stuff up. And, God, I look at it now, what a treasure trove was in there. You'd never see such things these days. And it would have been better for this thing to just stay outside, maybe, and rot with the bones and have it. For whatever reason, I've got it. So up on this mantle here is this little coffin that contained bones once in Borneo. I have other things too that are somewhat significant. And the one I'll tell a story about that is probably the most in the house is many years ago when I was in New Guinea, and on both sides, Papua New Guinea, but also the Indonesian side. And I preferred the Indonesian side. It's much more tribal there, much more, it's much wilder on the Indonesian side than the Papua New Guinea side. And the mountains are taller and it's much more remote. So out of the six trips I did to New Guinea, four were to the Indonesian side. It's been many years since I've been there. Nonetheless, I bring these things back from the jungle, and you're bringing back, you know, bring back things like weapons and, you know, knives and little bags that they would make, and carvings. They're really great into some of the artistic carvings and such, and paddles and spears. But one thing I got, I was in a village and this guy had this rock he wanted me to buy. And it was in this bag, and I didn't get it, you know, what was going on with it. And it was just him and me, and he didn't want anybody else around. And the bag that it was in was this strange little bag that had things like rat tails hanging from it and little jaws of animals and things. It was a little kind of a fetish bag is really what it was. And he takes this thing out, and it's just this brown, rounded thing. And it's not round shape, but the edges aren't sharp. And what I got from him was it had power. The thing had power. And he was telling me about it and said, well, thing is, never let anyone see it. Never, ever, ever let anyone see it. That was the rule. And I couldn't, unfortunately, my Indonesian isn't very good. And even his Indonesian wasn't good. So he was speaking the local tribal dialect, which I had none of. But I still knew it was important. Now, I don't know why he wanted to trade. He didn't want to trade everything. He needed money for something. And he would not budge a nickel on the price he wanted, which at the time seemed high to me. And, I just, in the end, just capitulated to the price, which still probably was around, you know, not very much, but maybe for him more than anything else, and thinking I've just got this kind of curiosity. Well, it's a strange thing. It's brown and the edges are rounded and it feels cold to the touch all the time. I don't know why, but it just seems like it is. And, I had a few, things with it through the years. And what it's taught me is you shouldn't mess with things that you don't understand. And I don't know what this thing really was, but I do think there's something going on with it. And I used it for several things through the years. And one, which I will talk about, was a tragedy that I'd love to say is just was just a fluke or just, but it just was too odd. And that was a little cat that I took in. We have many, many cats. This cat had a malady and was taken to the vet, and I was given a prognosis that was bad. And it was some kind of maybe a cancer or something, a bone thing in a joint. And it was, they were looking about was it spreading? And they said, we'll bring her back in about 6 months. Well, she was still kind of limping around a little bit. And I was just terrified because this poor little cat had problems from the start about bringing her back to the vet for the next prognosis, which was going to, you know, maybe be worse. And I used that rock, and I used it the way I would use it, touched it to her, said some words, touched it to her. She was afflicted. A friend of mine took her to the vet because the friend actually worked at that vet, which was a ways away. So she stopped by and picked her up. Her name is Mary, the cat. Put Mary in a little pink case, took her to the vet. And then I was thrilled when she called me on the way home and said, Mary's fine. Mary's okay. Whatever this is, it's not grown. It's nothing. She's just going to be fine. And I was happy beyond belief. So my friend dropped Mary off. I got the little pink case, took it out of the car, brought her into the house. And I was just getting her out of the case when I get a phone call. And it's my friend who had just taken Mary to the vet, and she had pulled into her driveway and killed another of our cats at that moment. Mm. And I just thought, you know, what are the chances? You know, that little cat was over there for years. It's kind of a jointly owned little thing, cute little cat. Just comes home. I just get it. I don't even have Mary out of the case, and this one's dead. So I don't know, you know, maybe total coincidence. I don't know.
I doubt it.
But, yeah. You know, it just was too close. I mean, like, she wasn't even out of the case yet. And it was like something said, okay, you got Mary, but I got this one.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I don't know.
An eye for an eye, basically.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So watch out when you use something like that.
Well, but that's the thing. A lot of times that stuff that seems like it's superstitious or it's another, you know, somebody else's religious practice and you discount it and say, well, that's just fiction. Minds mm-hmm. are powerful. And when they practice these kinds of rituals for hundreds, maybe thousands of years in their communities, there's a lot more weight, I think, that goes along with that. So that it would help if you had a better interpreter next time.
You bet. Yeah, I might have just let it keep it if I knew. Yeah. You know, it's like, no, yeah. you this needs to stay here.
Yeah.
At the time, I was like a vacuum cleaner wanting to bring these things home and own them and have them on display and be around them. And basically what I was doing was creating this atmosphere in my house that it's really what I wanted. It wasn't really the ownership of it, but it was to have it out and be around it and just, you know, have this feel when I sit in a room like I'm sitting in right now, where I'm looking at these incredible things from all around the world. It's quite a feeling.
Well, it sounds to me like it's an appreciation of the cultures, even though it may not be called a spiritual item, the things that you have, they certainly are, especially a coffin, reverential to yeah. life and death.
Yeah, I believe that. I don't know. You know, I've always been kind of a believer that certain things, most maybe many things have different types of energies. And I never took it lightly, anything I've ever brought back from some place. You know, I have some old Egyptian things, for example, and those people, boy, were they something else, the Egyptians and their beliefs. I certainly don't call that superstition.
What do you have?
Just little pieces. I've got a small statue and some other little things.
Wayne White, Cold, Three Winters at the South Pole. That's the book. This is the paranormal stuff that isn't in the book. A quick break.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Wayne White, continuing with some of the artifacts he's collected and why some are very unique.
When you said the rock is cold at all, or not rock, the item is cold at all times, do any of the other artifacts have that essence?
Nothing quite like that. I had a situation happen years ago that was funny with that, where a little niece of my, that was the niece of my wife, was here in the house, and I was telling them about stuff. And I said, you guys can touch things. Look, the only thing is I do have a rock in here that I don't want you to touch. And the little kid hadn't even been in the room. And she said, oh, that's on the door over there, and knew where it was. And that was an odd thing. And I want to check on that kid now to see, you know, how she's doing in life, because she hadn't seen it. And it was in a bag behind this door, kind of hung there out of the way. And she knew where it was.
Oh, yeah.
So
her antenna were working really good at that point.
Definitely. She definitely had a sense for that thing, and it kind of shocked me at the time because she hadn't been in that room.
Yeah.
but that's you know, probably those are the biggest things. A lot of the things are just, you know, simply were owned by someone and sat in an interesting place for a long time. But I've never gone out of my way to try to collect things that have energies or whatever. It's not something that I'm, you know, familiar with or that I seek. It's just that I do realize that things certain things more than others, you know, do have energies.
I'll go in the other direction and say it calls to you. So whether you acknowledge it or not, there's a little line that goes out like a fishing line with a hook.
Yeah.
And catches you.
Well, that's a good point. You know, I do have great respect for it. I would never be one to say that I understand it, or there's people out there that, you know, would have a better understanding than I do. But I think I do. I mean, that's the whole thing when I mentioned the thing with skeptic. I always have to be careful because, you know, I would love to believe these things. But I don't want to go so far as to just become an advocate without, you know, without really having good evidence that, that things exist. But I do see more and more, and you brought this up on your last program, and it was something I didn't forget. It had to do with, just because one person can't see it doesn't mean someone else can't.
Right.
And so we have different levels of reception to this. Like my wife, if I'd ask her, she would say, oh, no, never, nothing. You know, she's just that way. I might answer someone, like I made, you know, fun of about the UFO thing at the South Pole. I might answer somebody and kind of have some fun with it all. But then at the same time, hey, you know, who knows? You know, who knows about certain things?
Well, and I think in that house, your wife's attitude is probably a wonderful safeguard, because it doesn't bother her. It doesn't get near her. She has a nice solid lead box that says no.
Yes. Yeah. You are so right. You are so right. And because I've been gone so long and she's here alone, I'm really glad she thinks this way, because someone that didn't might get a little creeped out or something, you know, if they really got into this and they hear it by themselves at night. She, no feelings, nothing. There's no problem with that. She's okay. And that's different than I am.
Well, and the cats might run interference too, between, you know, might be going, don't you mess with our lady. Mm-mm, no way.
Yeah.
Don't mess with the cats.
I'll bet you've probably done programs on cats, or you have people. Cats are amazing little creatures. And I've seen them sometimes in a house staring into space, looking at things that it's like, what are you looking at? What, mm-hmm. what do you see that I'm not seeing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a reason the Egyptians, you know, had the god, what was it? Was it Anubis was their cat god, or what's their best cat or best cat, something like, whatever. The cats, I think, I don't know, but you'll see that sometimes in here where they're looking, and I'm looking, where are you looking over there?
Uh-huh.
Well, maybe they see something.
I think they say best you do not know. This is our job. We're on it.
That's probably it. I let them do it. I love my cats.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I thought was so interesting, before we did the last interview, you sent me a newspaper clipping and you said, I had a near-death experience. Now, I thought that might have been like the OBE, you know, go talk to God, something like that. No. This was actually even more literal. And that, so you were on a search to go find something then. Okay, so the call had gone out for Wayne, come pick up this wonderful little, was it a dart?
It was a blowgun and poison darts. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so nobody else on the planet, I think, would be called to go get a blowgun and poison darts out of the blue. But this came to you, on the search. And here's the near-death experience, because this is absolutely phenomenal.
Okay. This was many years ago, and I had this idea, and I don't know why, but I wanted to get a blowgun and poison darts from the Amazon. And so I actually made this trip down to South America, to Colombia, ended up in what's the capital of Colombia? I can't remember where I landed, but it doesn't really matter. I was, ended up on a flight, from their capital to, Leticia, Colombia, which is a little Amazon port, little tiny port in the Amazon that they have. That Colombia has this little sliver next to Brazil and Peru. And must be Ecuador, some on the other side. I don't know what's on the other side. But nonetheless, little sliver of Amazon port. This is many years ago, and I go down there. And there's troubles. This is 1985, I think, 1985. There's a lot going on in the Amazon area at that time with the drug trade and such. But, you know, I'm stupid, so I want the blowgun and poison darts. I get down there, I fly down. On the way, the aircraft, Bogota, that's where I flew into. Bogota, they went to Cali, Colombia. At Cali, Colombia, it had something wrong with the tire, and they get us all out. And then the airline goes on strike. And I thought, oh, my God. I mean, Cali, Colombia in 1985 was not a good time to be down here. The only gringo looks really out of place. Oh, this is going to be fun. But they fix the tire and say, yeah, we're going on strike. But we'll take you folks to Leticia down in the Amazon, because that's where you were going. So they take us to Leticia, little Amazon port, get off the aircraft, walk into town. You're in a backpack. And I'm walking down the street, and it's got a bad feel at the time. The guys at the airport, the police and things there, eyeing me, and, you know, I look way out of place, and what am I doing?
A drug runner?
Or the other side, or you know, DEA kind of thing, one or the other, either one, you know, would be, could be met equally badly. And so, you know, I head into the little downtown, and it's the Wild West, these little buildings, and they're playing this raucous music out on the streets. And it's really a raucous, crazy little Amazon port. And I stay in this little hotel thing on, you know, by the Amazon there. And, well, you hear like gunfire at night, stuff like that. It's really crazy. And I get a boat to take me upriver, to take me to a tribal group that I knew was up there. And I figured I could get a blowgun and poison darts and camp out a few days there. So I get in a little speedboat, takes me upriver, drops me off at this little Indian village that's right on the Amazon there. And I tell the guy, you know, come back in a week, I'll be here. And then I go into this village, and you know, people look at me, and I end up getting a guy to just take me out in the bush and make camp. And so I make camp, my tent, and get to experience things like the ants in the Amazon, amazing creatures. They really are. Never had insects watch me eat before, but I swear these things would swarm you. They were big too. But so I did it. Just a day or so of that, I could see I really wasn't going to make much headway out in this bush. And I headed back into their village. I did get my blowgun and poison darts. It was too early for the guy to pick me up so I ended up in a dugout canoe, and these Amazonia, these tribal guys dropped me off on this island in the middle of the Amazon. And then they say, you'll get a ride from here. So now I'm on this island in the middle of the Amazon. And I walk. It's a big island. Amazon's huge there. It's miles across or more. So this thing's a, you know, big island. It's not a little thing. It's big enough where I actually just make camp. I make camp on the island, and it's, you know, mile across or whatever or more. And so then the next morning, you know, break camp, and I decided I better get, you know, walk around and see where I can catch a boat from here. There's no people. I saw nothing. Just lizards and monkeys and things. So now I'm, you know, now I'm stuck in the middle of the Amazon, an island with lizards and monkeys. But I walk and I hear this noise, and there's kind of construction going on. I walk up on this thing, and it's this lodge kind of thing being built. And I walk in there, and they're real shocked to see me. And there's one guy that seems to be kind of in charge, and he's either Colombian or probably he's Colombian, I believe. And he's dressed real nice clothes, not like these kind of construction guys that are building things. He's wearing gold chains and nice clothes, and he's got a girlfriend that's Brazilian wearing this little mini skirt. They're really out of place for the kind of a lodge operation thing, although he was in charge, obviously, but he's sitting there having a drink. And, well, he wants to know who I am right away and, you know, questions me and who I am and all that. And I, you know, talk to him, and basically I'm just a dumb American down there looking for a blowgun and poison darts, which I have. I'm carrying the blowgun and poison darts.
Thank goodness.
You know, because you know where this is going with this guy, and it did end up being a lot more, you know, later, I found out. But nonetheless, we're talking, and I convinced him who I was, and he was a nice enough fellow. But one funny story was, while do we have time? Are we okay time-wise?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I put the blowgun and poison darts on the ground, just laying there while we're having a drink, and he's, you know, asking me who I am and all this, and I look down, and the blowguns or the poison darts are gone. Well, there's this monkey that was their little pet. I mean, they had little spider monkeys all around. They're squirrel monkeys. They're almost like a squirrel, you know, they're not so monkeyish. But the one they had was like a little rhesus monkey. He was cute. He had a little name. He'd come and climb on you and lick you and stuff like that. And he was little, I don't know what his name was, but whatever, he was cute as heck, and he was their little pet. He's got my poison dart, the monkey, and I'm thinking, oh no. So next thing you know, I'm chasing this monkey, and he's running with my poison darts, and boy, those monkeys are fast. And all I'm thinking of is, he's going to kill himself with these poison darts, and they're going to kill me.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And so, boy, this monkey, he's a monkey.
He's playing.
Oh my God. He runs down to the water, and he jumps in his boat, but he drops the darts, thank God. So I get him back. You know, I dodge that bullet, get back. And the guy, he's really nice. And he says, he says, hey, Wayne, I'll give you a ride get back down river. And other than a speedboat, it cost me a bunch of money, but he was willing to do it for free. You know, he said, I'll go down there anyway. Well, anyway, so he gets his girlfriend loaded up, and later we go down, and he gives me a ride on a speedboat all the way back down. And I never forget, last time I saw him, you know, he waves me, and then I found out later a little more about that guy in the story. But nonetheless, for now, I head back into Leticia. And as I'm walking through town, I see the little Avianca office that had gone on strike is now open. Because that was the other thing. They're on strike. I have no way to get out of this place. So I don't know how long I'm going to be in Leticia. But it's a little box, a little tiny office is open. I go in there, and this woman's there. And it's like, okay, I want out tomorrow. When can I go? I got my blowgun of poison dart. And so I say, when's the next aircraft? She says, mañana. I say, okay, mañana. And then she goes, no. I go, no, mañana, I'll go to mañana. She keeps telling me this stuff, and I can't understand it. It's mañana, there's an aircraft. I say, I want to go. And then she says, no, the aircraft, you know, not an Avianca. I don't really understand what she's saying, but there's an aircraft. And I finally just give up. I say, okay, I leave. And I walk across, and I put my pack, and I walk across the border into Brazil. It was an open border at that time. There's no checkpoint. Just across the selva, the jungle there. And I'm in Brazil. And so I go out there, and I end up making camp at this place where they're doing slash and burning agriculture, and these new farmers that are coming from the big cities are living. I had a real good time out there. I wasn't there but a day or so. And I then finally thought, oh, well, I better get back to Leticia, see what's going on there. So I walked back across the border. It's a number of miles that I've walked back across the border, and I get into Leticia. When I get into Leticia, the little raucous town, instead of the kind of raucous type, you know, happy music they play on the street, they're playing this somber funeral type stuff, real somber, somber stuff. And as I'm going down the street, this guy runs out of this building and says, Senor Blanco White. Says, Senor Blanco, the American embassy is looking for you. I said, you know, boy, why would that be? And then I put what's happened all together. What happened was this. When I went in that Avianca office, you know, asked to leave, the woman said, no, I couldn't get on a flight. The flight wasn't an Avianca flight. What happened was they brought in, since Avianca was on strike, the government knew they had to get people out. They couldn't leave them stranded down in Leticia forever. So they flew a little DC-6 in that loaded up around 77 people total with the crew and all. And I would have been on that flight. I was on the manifest to be on it. All she was telling me was it wasn't an Avianca flight, but there was a flight the next day, and I didn't understand it. I thought there was no flight. So I crossed the border and then ended up in Brazil. That flight took off and at 10 miles out crashed into the jungle and killed everybody. So they were all dead. And my name was on the flight manifest, and I ended up in the newspaper down there along with the list of the passengers. I have that framed on my wall at home here now. My misunderstanding, and all it would have taken was for me to have a little better Spanish, for her to have a little better English, or for just someone else being in that office saying, oh yeah, you can go. It's just not an Avianca flight. And I'd have been on that flight. So, you know, they were identifying bodies and calling, you know, telling my wife every time they'd identify like 10 that it wasn't me. And she made the nicest comment to them. I mean, I got to say, it's pretty egotistical of me, but it was the nicest comment. She said, if there's anyone that survived it, he will be the one. Well, I did, but not because of any great jungle adventure or, you know, when I hit the ground, I rolled and, you know, no, I wasn't on it. That's how I survived. But they were identifying the bodies and things. And it was a terrible, terrible, terrible tragedy.
Did they find out the source, the cause?
Yeah, they found out that it was leaking hydraulic fluid when it flew in. People had noticed that it was, you know, poor maintenance. It suffered some kind of a defect in the air, and they had the pilot's last transmission that says we're crashing.
Oh.
And then they went in, just burnt right, almost head down into the jungle, and just burnt this kind of a hole. That's what the photo looks like, this kind of hole in the jungle. But you know, that was one of those things where, you know, I don't know the big plan for things or how things work, but it was a real close call. And then it was another close call with those guys upriver, because what happened later was, interestingly enough, that whole thing at the time was a real front operation for a major cocaine distribution center. And without mentioning names, one of the fellows that was running that was then placed in a federal prison for 27 years. And at that time, it was the largest cocaine bust in U.S. history. And they were using animals and using this thing that was going back to a zoo in Florida to smuggle drugs in. That's what that was all about. So, you know, I thank that guy for not shooting me.
Yeah.
You're thinking I was out looking at things because he must have figured I was dumb enough that I really did want them. Because he did ask me a lot what I saw, and I saw nothing but lizards, monkeys.
And ants.
Yeah, and ants, big ants. So I didn't say anything about, well, I saw these big bales of white stuff. And
Good thing.
That would have been the end of me. So I was dumb enough and innocent enough, and he was perceptive enough to know I was telling the truth. And I'll always thank him for that act of kindness, because that's not how they dealt with people.
I don't know. I think meeting the guy who wanted to get the blow done in darts was probably very entertaining. You had to have some good stories to go along with that.
Well, he laughed, and he was a jovial guy. You know, he didn't fit in with the jungle lodge persona with these really nice clothes and gold chains and things like that. But I remember the last thing he said to me, I got out of his boat in Leticia, and I was kind of making my way somewhere just away from the boat, and I turned a certain direction, and he yelled, "Wayne, Brazil is that way." Yeah, that's the last thing he said.
Just to give you a little help. Well, you know, that the stories that you have, I think part of that has to do with you. When you are called to go somewhere, there's something else asking for this favor, and possibly that what you did is to retrieve something that's meant to be part of the story and meant to be part of that collection. I don't know where it's going to go after you have it, but I believe you're holding it for someone else.
Yeah. Everything, most things here, some things I'll sell off that are just things, but there's a few items here that have stories and things like that. That has quite a story, and especially when I had that on the Avianca aircraft. I had the full blowgun. It's about 6 feet or so. It's not one of the biggest ones, but they're about 6 feet. I actually carried it on to the, without the poison darts, they were in my check-in. But still, I have a blowgun from all the way to Florida. Both flights on Avianca let me do it, but I got to Florida. I walked in there. I tried to tell the agent it was a walking stick. Well, they know blowgun. So that was the end of its trip with me in the, you know, in the cabin.
Yeah,
but,
okay.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, all right. What is it that drives you when you went to the South Pole, I'm sorry, and you are out walking? How many was it by the end of your tour of duty, which was like 3 years, how many miles had you? 4,000?
It was over 3 winters and 2 summers, almost 3 years in length, and broken up a little bit. I ended up walking over 4,000 miles outside, and sometimes it'd simply be half mile out to the science building, the telescopes and back. But other times it was out, you know, much farther in the direction where, you know, was really nothing out there. And I enjoyed that incredible solitude, that incredible being alone, but not feeling alone in another way. You know, it's like you look at the universe, or you look up and you see the stars, and you're at the South Pole and there's nobody there. And then you see this magnificent aurora. And it's just a feeling that's just like nothing else. And I got to really love it. I was very nervous about it. I don't ever approach things nothing as a daredevil. Anytime I've ever been cocky in life, I've had issues. And I'm not cocky often. It just doesn't work for me. So I approached my walking very, very carefully, you know, to being out away from that station and, you know, how I was dressed, what I had with me, you know, how to get back in storms and things with great respect and caution. Well, I didn't want anybody, a crew member, to have to go look for me. That would have been terrible.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Whiteout, you know, you have to be aware of your directions, and with no visibility, know where the heck you are.
Yeah. And I used to do things once I got a level of confidence and knew more what I was doing. I'd go out in storms and spin around and try to disorient myself and, you know, and then get back from there. Now, it should be said that there's people that cross Antarctica and they're on skis and they're pulling sleds, and they do that all the time. It's done, you know, a sport thing. To me, it's more of a sporting thing than anything else. But they have food and fuel and a tent and all those things with them where they can stop. I'm out walking a few miles from the station. I don't have anything. I got to get back with what I have. So it's a little bit different thing, and you got to be really, really, really careful. I wouldn't recommend it. But I approached it cautiously, took my time. And like I said, doing those spinnings around in the storms was kind of interesting, you know, and then get oriented to where I was. I wasn't that far out, a few miles out, you know, I could get back.
Okay, so you're basically in good condition. Did you ever do breathing exercises?
Interestingly enough, like for what purpose? Because I did breathe differently there, but it was for a reason. When I would walk, I have two balaclavas. If you see any photos, like in my book, Cold, Through Winters at the South Pole, my whole face, I'm wearing this balaclava, and they're just kind of a slit for my eyes. There's actually two covering my mouth, and so you can't see my mouth. And as I walk, I'm breathing into it on purpose because the vapors are freezing up in ice, icing that up, and that would keep my face warm. It created this kind of void space. Amazing to think ice could keep you warm, but an igloo works the same way. You can be warmer in an igloo than outside. And so by walking, it forced me to breathe like that, you know, kind of like when you're scuba diving. Any scuba divers out there will recognize that. Mm-hmm. So I was breathing that way the whole time while I was walking for that reason, to ice that thing up, and the vapor would keep my face warm.
I was curious just because of that. It isn't just, okay, I take a breath and we're good.
You see, the other thing about the South Pole is you're sitting at 9,300 feet. You're sitting on almost 2 miles of ice. So not just walking, you're walking on this level, fairly level surface. It's got, of course, it's not flat. But the fact is you're at 9,300 feet and there's a physiological factor that can make it feel like it's over 12,000 feet to the human body. So you feel that lack of oxygen. And that's particularly for new people flying in. They can end up having high altitude sickness coming from the coast and hitting, you know, a feeling of 12,000 feet within 3 hours can be really bad for people. Mm-hmm. It's definitely dangerous.
Yeah. That isn't something you think about unless you've done a little bit of research going to the South Pole.
Yeah. And you'll feel it, Wendy. When you get there, you'll be, you know, I was always in good shape, but every time I arrived, there's definitely a tiredness that you're getting right away from that altitude and the lack of oxygen, and it takes a little bit to get used to it. Yeah. And some people don't get used to it.
Yeah, you have to get oriented. I think, what was it, Buzz Aldrin who went?
Yeah, I was there when Buzz Aldrin was there. And I write about it in the book because it was kind of a funny story how it all went down. But, you know, Buzz Aldrin is an iconic figure. And, you know, here I am, a kid in Iowa at a swimming pool, hearing that the Eagle has landed. And then later that night on a tiny little grainy black and white TV, you know, watching him walk on the moon. And here I'm at the South Pole talking to this guy. You know, he's just an iconic character. And he was ill and we had to get him out of there, medevac him out of there. But, you know, just to be in a situation where I'm at the South Pole and get to meet someone like that, even under those situations, is a really amazing thing. And he is an amazing fellow.
Yeah, he is. He's definitely an icon. I really appreciate you talking about the paranormal element, because sometimes people who are collectors don't realize that sometimes there's an energy that goes along with this. And so be prepared. If you're not meant to be the keeper of that particular object, it won't stay with you.
I agree. And you might not like some of the things that happened too.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
It just depends.
Be forewarned. And I hope that little rock that you have been guardian of has a specific home. Obviously it does, or you wouldn't have ended up with it. But that'll be an interesting transition.
Yeah, I've got to be careful with that one. But it's been an honor being on your show. I think you're wonderful, and I love your questions, and I love what you do.
Thank you. Well, now the next question is, where are you going?
I don't know. I'm going actually to I'm back from a tragic event. It was one of my former crew members was killed in an air crash in Washington. I spoke at his celebration of life just a couple of days ago. But on a more positive side, I'm speaking in Colorado, University of Colorado, Colorado Springs next week. I'm kind of formulating what the future is going to hold. I'm trying to, you know, hope the book does well, and we'll see. So I'm not sure. I'm enjoying my cats right now. Oh, my wife too. My wife also.
Yeah, she knows. She's been around enough. Yeah. Okay. Now that's Wayne. Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate your time. And I know whatever you're going to do, it'll be an adventure.
I'll keep you posted, Wendy. And thanks again. It was fun.
Again, Wayne's book, Cold, Three Winters at the South Pole, available on Amazon. And I'll put links in the description for the show. Thanks for listening. Stay curious.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.